when I meet a founder that's looking to start a digital health company, I always tell them, look, it's the double black diamond of entrepreneurship. It is not for the faint of heart. And the most important thing that one should reflect on is the why. Because if you look at what honestly is the most important ingredient in any company's success, it's just grit and determination and just kind of powering through challenges. If you don't have a sense for the why, it's tough to muster what's needed to do that.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. It's not often a digital health company gets to ring the bell on the stock exchange when they go public. Last year was a big year for today's guest, Sean Duffy. He shepherded Omada Health to one of the first IPOs in recent digital health history. And he says it was a total thrill. But for this conversation, we kept finding our way back to the founding insight that sparked Omada in the first place. Sean's why. Over and over, Sean kept hearing the same thing from people living with diabetes or pre-diabetes. They felt alone. They were under the care of a doctor, but they were not feeling cared for. When you have a chronic condition, health is created by the 99% of life you spend between visits, not the brief encounters you have with your clinicians. Omada Health was born to create an alternative care model for chronic care, one that is virtual, continuous, and powered by both human connection and technology. Please welcome Sean Duffy to The Other 80. Well, Sean, welcome to the show. I was going back, I was listening to your conversation with Hallie and remembering our first meeting, which I think, I don't know if it was during JPM or not, but I remember it was in a hotel lobby. My colleague Ryan said, you have to meet with my friend Sean. You were in the first class of Rock Health. I just remember you being so passionate. I went into that meeting thinking, like, what is this? I don't understand it. You were so passionate and compelling about the vision, which makes it all the more exciting that we're here today with your company having gone public last year. Just taking us back to that moment when you were first building and first conceiving of this, what do you think you saw that other people didn't in that time?
Well, thank you so much for the kind words and honor to be on. And I mean, germane to your question, there's kind of an experience in the early days that frankly, I still remember to this day over a decade later. And it was sitting in the homes of people in the burbs of Atlanta who had obesity, prediabetes, diabetes, and asking them, a lot of questions about what it felt like to be in the healthcare system with those diseases. And the funny reflection that I had, which is really what inspired Omada, is the healthcare academic would look at those people and say, oh, they're under care. They have primary care docs, they've been prescribed medicines, they're under care. But they didn't feel like they had care. And it was very obvious that without a different care model that involved day-to-day, between-visit, longitudinal support, they were heading down the wrong trajectory, with their health. We had some of these people just kind of say, Sean, you have to do this. You have to take a swing at it. And that was really the founding insight, is just that the care models were not suited to many of these disease areas that are crippling the country.
I have a friend who's a patient advocate who has Parkinson's, and she has this beautiful chart that has all these dots. And they're all blue, except one is red. They're like hundreds of dots. And they represent the time spent caring for herself versus the time in the visit. And it just, we all know that. We experience that ourselves as patients. But yet, we can so easily fall into the trap of thinking, it's just about making those 5 minutes a little better, right? It's like those 5 minutes are never going to be better enough that they make a difference in caring for those kinds of things. Thinking, again, staying in that backwards-forwards kind of mode, what do you feel like you got 100% right there at the beginning, like that it stayed true, that stayed constant the whole time? And what might have shifted as you've grown the company now addressing multiple conditions beyond pre-diabetes?
Yeah, well, I think the insight that we had that's really stuck with us is that there won't be a silver bullet in supporting people, in chronic disease areas. And, Omada's taken a pretty full stack approach. You're going to need the accountability of a person. You're going to need incredible hardware. You're going to need great tracking, great content. And we saw companies that did one of all of those things. And we took on the burden of trying to create everything and tying it together that was required. And that belief from the early days is held true. And it just, every time we talk to a member about what makes Omada different and unique, little bits and pieces of all of those elements shine through.
One of the things that was really striking from the very beginning is the belief in needing to show clinical impact and outcomes that actually you are shifting the health trajectory for people and communities. I read your SEC filings this morning. It was actually incredibly interesting reading.
Okay.
Not every little word, but it was really interesting. And one of the things I really took away from that is all of these outcomes you've been able to show, which is partly because you've really very strongly said, we're not here to compete with the clinicians. We're here to support their work. We share goals. Also, obviously, you're selling to employers and other folks that care about those health outcomes. What are one or two outcomes you've been able to demonstrate over the last 10 plus years that really say to you as the leader of this organization, this is working?
You know, it's, I mean, so we're proud. I think you referenced 29 publications. We're now at 30, and just, which is amazing. And we started that from the very, very early days at Omada. And I actually kind of didn't realize that there wasn't such a standard in digital health to publish, but I equally founded the company while in medical school. And I recognized that at some point, you know, I'd have to pass the medical director's test. I'd have to convince my, you know, critical medical school classmates that our solutions work. I mean, recently we've been doing a lot of work in diabetes. And in one of the trials, we saw members with A1C over 8 get a 2-point reduction in A1C. And that's just, you know, enormously impactful to their long-term health. And, you know, it's one of those where, again, in large part, these people, they have primary care clinicians and they are quote unquote under diabetes care, but still they're sitting uncontrolled. They're sitting under-resourced. They don't feel the sense of, you know, health care that they should. And so it's really neat to see outcomes like that. But we're really proud of the robust portfolio across, you know, prevention, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, you know, MSK, both from a clinical and an economic standpoint.
And paint a picture for us of that patient under care that has moved from seeing the clinician maybe once a month, maybe once every 6 months, to feeling supported. What does that actually look like in a day-to-day for that patient?
Well, so it can be a very lonely experience. Let's just say you have diabetes. What happens is you go into your doc, you know, they check your sugar, check your A1C, give you medicine and say, come back in 6 months. And nobody likes that. The patient doesn't like it because, again, you don't have any support on a daily basis. The clinicians don't like it. You know, it's a very painful feeling to send a patient out only hoping that they come back in 6 months, knowing that they don't have the support needed. And you've seen so many patients not progress, not get healthier, that nobody wins in that model. And so, but that's just, that's the standard of care right now for many millions of Americans with chronic diseases. And that's a standard that, you know, frankly, is unacceptable and can be changed, but it needs a different care model, different reimbursement structure, you know, different, you know, levels of technology investment. Well, why don't I just describe the member experience? You know, you find out that you have Omada that's covered. That could happen either through, you know, an email that you get from us or from your employer or, you know, your doc, if it's through one of our relationships with an integrated health system. And step one is we get you hardware. So you've got to be able to measure, you've got to be able to monitor, you know, biometric progress. And so we have a mini arsenal of hardware that includes a connected scale, a blood pressure cuff, a glucometer, you know, CGMs if you have diabetes. The scale, blood pressure cuff, and glucometer are cellular enabled. And the reason that that's the case is I always say that anything we build has to pass John Duffy's mom test. you know, because my mom's probably not pairing a Wi-Fi scale with her home network. So it's really neat. So you get your hardware, it just works out of box. Great. You've got the ability to yourself see your biometric progress as well as your care team. And then you meet your care team. And these are different professionals based on, of course, what you need. But let's use diabetes as an example. You'll have a health coach. And you'll have a certified diabetes care and education specialist. And these individuals, they start by getting to know you. And they ask, well, what are your goals with your health? You know, what does it feel like to you to have diabetes? You know, get to know what medicines you're on, why you're taking them, why you're not. and really try to build a sense of trust, you know, which is a really amazing thing because so many of our members, they tell us that, you know what, no one's even asked my goals. You've got to start there. And then you align with your care team on really the plan for the next couple of weeks. And then there's a surround sound of community, social support, these really cool topic-based communities, tracking either biometric, meals, activity, all within the Omada Care experience. And so what it distills to for many members is finally not feeling alone. Mm. And finally having a sense that someone is in my corner. They're rooting for me. They're cheering me on. They're holding me accountable. And I'm working to improve my health, not just for me, but for them. And that's the difference maker.
Mm, interesting. And I think you mentioned the financial model. And one of the things that you've talked about quite a bit is rejecting what was common at the time when you started the company, which was a per member per month payment. If I had an employer and I have 2,000 employees, you would just get a payment for every single employee. And you've pointed out that that created an adverse incentive to actually engaging people and getting them into your care. What did it take to shift that model early on?
Yeah, no, you know, it's funny. When I learned that a lot of companies priced in that way, it felt broken, per your comments, because you really want your pricing model aligned with your impact. And the issue with a model where you're charging, 30 cents, a buck, $2 for every single person, regardless of if they're using, is if more people use it as a company, that would compress your margins. And so by definition, that pricing model is counter to scaled impact. And so, what Omada endeavored to do is, it sounds so obvious, but it's only charge if people sign up. And so many people in the early days said, you're not going to be able to business like that. You're never going to be able to get people in once it's so hard, even once you get people in to change health outcomes. And so Omada's pricing model is a monthly fee that we only charge if we're continuing to support someone. But what it did is really help us get very, very good at enrolling people, articulating the why to them, getting great at just marketing this as a benefit. And equally, because we don't get revenue unless, people actually are in the program and we're supporting them, it put our feet to the fire from a product innovation standpoint. I think that's very healthy. Both of those dynamics are very healthy and that alignment's very important.
And I think that really underscores the multiple sell you have to make, right? You're selling to the people that are paying your revenue and they have goals, but then ultimately you're actually selling to the customer. And I think companies often get tripped up by focusing on only one and not the other. And you really have to create a value proposition that works for both sides. A trope I've heard a lot in this space is that it's impossible to sell to employers. And so I've seen a lot of companies focus on managed care, Medicare. Managed care is a particularly common target, but you've really focused on the employer as the purchaser. And you work with plans, you work with PBMs, but often they're the channel partners, not the ones that actually pay your bottom line. What made that work? And was that your original intent, or was it because the health plans were too slow? So kind of talk us through what made that approach work for you and how you got there in the beginning.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm chuckling here a little bit because I remember being a couple of years ago at this happy hour with a bunch of entrepreneurs in healthcare. And you had some that sold employers, some that sold a plan, some providers, some life sciences, and everyone was hoping that the sales cycles were quicker on the other side.
Right. But everyone left the conversation completely depressed. Right.
It takes just as long no matter
what. And then the hospital people were like, wait a minute, I need to change.
Yeah, for sure. So, enterprise healthcare, the sales cycles do tend to be long. Omada's route to market actually, though again, in the early days was a bit more pointed to employers. At the end of the day, it's employer plan and integrated health system as the three routes to market. I mean, we as of the end of 2024, we have actually about 14% of the self-insured ASO market in the US sold, 9% of fully insured. It is really split. So there are a number of health plans that, sometimes after they see success within their ASO or self-insured population, write us into the fully insured. But employers, employers are really an incredible force of innovation that I think don't get enough credit in U.S. healthcare. Because the reason that they even open the door to organizations like Omada is because they believe that the current ecosystem and the payment models of their existing provider network that's serving their employees and the health plans that are administering it is not fixing the issue. And they see rising costs, they see rising disease burden, they see the impact on their employees, they see the productivity impact. And equally, they're in a position where deploying new innovative healthcare solutions creates kind of a beneficial experience for culture. I think HR benefits leaders in many ways are the unsung heroes of healthcare innovation because Omada couldn't have existed without them. If you're an HR benefits leader out there listening to this, thank you because you're really helping press innovation forward.
Your model is particularly well suited to that because you're not trying to build a clinical network in a city. You're not trying to figure out how to pay for the pharma. Like, you're really engaging people in a way that's much more similar to the way an employer would around their health, their well-being. So it makes so much sense that that would be tied to the employer.
And a lot of these employers, I mean, they have people in every state. They want solutions that are scaled, that can help their whole workforce. And so, virtual care model, between visit care model is really a great fit.
Just pulling the threads of some of the things you've said that have made you successful. One is really building a soup to nuts solution, covering multiple conditions. So an employer could come to you and say, these are my biggest cost drivers and there's overlap between them. And then having something that's scalable across the country. And that all makes total sense. But if I'm a startup just starting today, that's going to seem like an impossible leap to have a fully soup to nuts solution to do multiple things. So how would you take those lessons of what's worked for you and give advice to the Sean Duffy that I met back in the day?
For sure.
Those are the right conclusions, but you can't leap all the way there. So how would you think about distilling that lesson?
You know, I think that the first is to accept the truth that enterprise healthcare entrepreneurship is extremely difficult. When I meet a founder that's looking to start a healthcare company, a digital health company, I always tell them, look, it's the double black diamond of entrepreneurship. It is not for the faint of heart. And the most important thing that one should reflect on, and I'll try to ask, is the why. Because at the end of the day, building a business is hard no matter what you're doing. I mean, if you're a SaaS entrepreneur, consumer entrepreneur, it almost doesn't matter. You're fighting gravity. It's very, very difficult to build any business. And the why tends to be the most important part, because if you look at what honestly is the most important ingredient in any company's success, it's just grit and determination and just powering through challenges. If you don't have a sense for the why, it's tough to muster what's needed to do that. And the beautiful thing, which is kind of a nice balance to the difficulty of healthcare entrepreneurship, is there's some incredible whys. And we see them on a quarterly basis when we bring our members in to our town halls to talk about their experience with Omada. And that why is powerful, and that allows you to overcome the challenges. And so to your point, I mean, it's almost like an acceptance that it's not going to be easy and there's not going to be a shortcut. And I think once you grow Zen with that, it allows you to in a sense, to do it. And you've got to raise a lot of capital. You have to, take the long game. You have to find patient investors. You have to suffer through really long sales cycles. And you just build a business recognizing that it's not going to be easy.
Hmm. My son's CEO of a small company, and I will bring this advice back to him. I think every year has been a big year for Omada, but last year was a particularly big year because you took the company public. What's interesting is obviously the success of the company itself, but also this is widely being viewed as a thawing or a proof point for digital health, right? That there are public market opportunities for digital health under certain conditions. My question for you is, abstracting from your experience, what are those conditions? What are the conditions under which we can see public market success for the other companies that have maybe been waiting in the wings and interested in going public?
I mean, it feels like years ago, crazily enough, that we went public, even though it was just last year. that's how much time is flying. And I think to your comment, the bar is quite high right now within the digital health ecosystem for companies being able to go public. The reason the bar is high is because we're at a bit of a fulcrum point in an industry going from like digital health 1.0 to 2.0, where 1.0 is a little bit more either technology models that were incremental on the existing system, or like things that sold into like an HR, benefits leaders wellness budget. Whereas 2.0, and I'd put us and Hinge in that category, I mean, we are delivering the care. As providers, we're filing claims, it's unique value-based billing models, different care models, leveraging technology differently. I think investors are starting to appreciate that difference. And that appreciation is the result of both education, on Omada's parts, them seeing other kind of next-gen digital health companies with similar models and similar profiles, And then fundamentally from financial performance in Q3 25, it was a $68 million revenue quarter, 49% year-over-year growth. GAAP net loss narrowed. It was $3 million versus $9 million in Q3 24. We were adjusted EBITDA positive, $2 million. and so it's just the steady progress and top line growth as well as bottom line progress. Thankfully, I'm really optimistic. There are many really neat companies in this kind of digital health 2.0 category that hopefully over the coming years find their way to the public markets.
One of the other things you talked about, which I loved, is that going public brings financial rewards, but also puts new wind in your sail, right? It allows you to, in preparation and post the event, to think even bigger about what's possible, and also to bring, as you said, a new discipline and accountability, which has always been there, but it just requires you to double down on that. Talk a little bit more about where it's placed the company and what the impact has been.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. I mean, you'll find various voices. There's kind of like the Reed Hastings camp and the Michael Dell camp. And the Reed Hastings camp is like, go public. It benefits the business. You'll look back on it, and in both the discipline and the new opportunities are worth it. And then Michael Dell is like, don't go public. Why would you? You can access capital.
Why would he say that, I wonder?
You can access capital and liquidity on the private side. What I've observed at Armada is even the preparations to be able to thrive on the public markets and the productivity and the operational discipline it requires, just build a better business. And ultimately, who that serves the most is our customers and our members. Because we're delivering a very, very complex technology and service at scale to diverse customer types, diverse members, all across the country, all 50 states, within a complex regulatory environment. And when you go public, the bar is higher for operational discipline and reliability. And that means that we're serving our customers and our members better. That fundamentally, I think, is the most important, especially per your point. Now it's time to really reach from the stars. Omada's explicit mission is to bend the curve. It's to bend the curve of disease. And we've not done it yet. I'm proud that at the end of Q3, we got 831,000 members, but that's not bending the curve of disease yet. And you've got to hit scale and reliability to do that, and being public helps.
What would be the marker that you had successfully bent the curve?
Well, it's fun. I mean, we've got a little internal project where we're trying to quantify that and perhaps put it in a peer-reviewed model and publication. And
that would be bold. You put your goals out there, right?
There we go. What a privilege to be able to even say that we can start to think about the math. Because the team has always heard me from the very, very early days say, like, look, success for us is tomorrow's epidemiologists. They notice a bend in incidence curves. And they're like, what the heck happened? And obviously, we're not going to be the whole solution, but we have to be part of it. When you go public, you're kind of at the starting line of this next chapter. And on our foundation, we're beginning to think, how big do we need to dream to see us show up in the nation's epi data? And so that's kind of a fun and a privileged place to be and to be thinking.
This is a little bit of a calm before the storm. And some of us took a break. We're back at work this week. But next week at San Francisco is going to be crazy with JPM.
It will. Is it going to rain? I haven't checked the weather yet. I'm always nervous.
No, it's supposed to be nice.
Oh,
no
phew, rain. Okay.
Yeah. And the two things that are already buzzing, if you looked at LinkedIn or whatever, GLP-1s and AI. And on the one hand, yes, those are huge. But I think we're all a little bit bored with that conversation. What my ask of you is, how do we make it not boring? Like, what is actually important about this beyond the buzz, beyond the words that are on everybody's mind?
It is buzzy. I always joke that Omada, it's always, the last couple of years and this year will be the year of the G's. So GLPs, GPT, because every conversation turns into it. I would say, like, how to get beyond the hype. I'll take each one individually. In AI, it's the substantive use case. It's like, it's too easy to reflexively say, oh, now we have a chatbot within our app, we're doing AI. It's too easy to say, oh, don't worry, we don't need people anymore, we're just doing AI. But it's pulling back the hype and being like, specifically, what are you trying to solve? And what job are you doing for your user? We launched Omada Spark. It's a member-facing agentic experience, but we're using it for specific use cases like meal planning, recipe generation. It's the things that the model's excellent at. Yet equally, our members say they don't feel accountable to their large language models. They feel accountable to their care teams. And so that blend between AI and people, I think, is the way to get beyond the hype next week at JPM? And like, what is the use case? What are you doing for the user? And just get as specific as possible. So that's kind of category one. And then GLPs, the big thing that we see on a daily basis that I don't think the world sees as well as we do, but hopefully they will soon, is that these are medicines that can catalyze behavior change. And
I just want to pause there because I think the way it's perceived by people using them as well as the clinical team is behavior change failed and now we have a workaround. So what you just said is really important.
Absolutely. And you're right that that's the, behavior didn't work, let's use GLPs. It's kind of the opposite. I mean, literally, I was reading a member testimonial story like before our podcast here, chatting with our president, just so inspiring. And it's this member that felt a positive psychology by starting the med. Imagine you've got a BMI of 43. You don't love that you're overweight. You don't love the way that you feel. You don't love the trajectory that you feel your health is on. And there's a lot of self-criticism. There's a lot of negativity relative to your feeling relative to your health. A GLP-1 gets the ball rolling. And all of a sudden, maybe after trying 1,000 crash diets and that month's flavor of nutritional approach that's restrictive and failing, you're losing weight and you're feeling better about your health. And that creates a positive psychology that if you harness it, which we see on a daily basis with our GLP-1 care track, can turn into more open-mindedness about making changes in your life. You're more open-minded to having a conversation on, walk me through like a week in your eating with your family. What foods do you like? What do you dislike? Have you heard about nutrient density? Did you know that restrictive diets fail? you can do that with a member. Hey, is there anything that you've wanted to do physically you've never done that you might be able to do on this trajectory? How about we work toward that? You've wanted to walk a 5K. Amazing. Let's find one online. So there's a positive psychology. And if you grab it and keep the ball rolling, that can turn into lasting behavior change. And so there is this incredible magic in the intersection between GLP-1s and behavior that can be seized if the two are blended together that we just see, and it leaves us so inspired. And we've seen some incredible success with members that have been through our care track, that have tried to get off the med and have been able to do that successfully out to a year.
And I think it was 63% maintained. Is that right?
We put out some data 12 months post discontinuation. The average weight change was 0.8%. So that the tiniest amount of regain on an average basis. Like you said, over 60% maintained weight or continued to lose weight at the 12 month mark. That's a great testament to our members being able to be successful. And I think the best framing that I tend to use is you would not run a marathon tomorrow without training. It's no different with a GLP. I mean, you wouldn't try to get off a GLP without a little bit of training and getting ready to do it.
Another organization that's been very busy over the last several months, which is CMS, and they have released two new models. I used to work for the office, ONC, the HHS, and we used to call it the Office of No Christmas. I think, I don't know if that's true for CMS or not, they launched.
December was busy.
It was busy, right? They launched two models that I think are very interesting for Omada and other digital health companies, Access and Balance.
That's right.
And we'll share with listeners specifics for anyone who doesn't know about that. But what I'd love to have you talk about is what is the market opportunity this creates for you and other digital health founders? And how are you thinking about the go-to-market for this? Because mainly you've been focused in the past on commercial insurance.
Relative to Access and Balance, obviously Balance is newer. And frankly, both models, there's still details forthcoming, but they're both very inspiring. The more that I've run through the kind of almost like the checklist that what a theory could make Access, use that one for a second, a success for the country, I'm like, you know what? There is incredible goodness there. Does the structure enable releasing the handcuffs from a fee-for-service model? Yes. It's a monthly fee. Is it targeted toward outcomes? Yes, there's going to be outcomes-based rewards for the company. Is there accountability? Yes, the outcomes will be published. Does it enable integration in any fashion with the existing fee-for-service system? Yes, primary care docs have the ability to get payment in some capacity by partnering with access providers. You start to like just run through the maze of what key details would need to be in place for it to potentially scale and have impact. And I think CMS nailed it. credit to the team over there. I think this one hopefully is set up for success. Now, again, there's details forthcoming, including what the pricing models are going to look like, et cetera. And so, you know, we're excited, but we're listening and learning. And of course, you know, should the stars align relative to making it viable, we'd love to lean in and participate. But again, there's a lot of details that are still forthcoming.
What about balance?
Yeah, I mean, same. It's really exciting. What we love about that is it emphasizes the fact that GLP-1s alone don't seize the opportunity. And I think that's the key fundamental piece. And they're putting the ask to manufacturers to, if they're interested in Medicare coverage of these medicines, to enable lifestyle alongside. So I think obviously in the strike zone relative to our belief systems here at Omada and in both of those. And it's neat to see that sense of kind of entrepreneurial zeal from CMS and folks kind of dreaming big.
So assuming those details get worked out and this is a big market opportunity, what would the go-to-market look like for access for you?
Well, it'll be about how we get people in. And so let's imagine you're a Medicare fee-for-service member and you're covered via access for something like Omada. How do you find out about us? And that could be through the CMS front door. It could be through a direct, you know, marketing to members. Equally, it could be through your existing primary care doc. And so we have some experience, obviously, in all of those. I mean, Omada does work with integrated health systems. So the Intermountains of the world, where we're in great partnership with the existing care teams. My pet project that every year I try to progress is to find ways to get Omada services closer and closer to someone's medical home and, you know, in primary care, because people have needs other than what we do. And it's kind of a better together thing where, you know, so many of my friends who are now practicing clinicians keep saying, well, when can I just prescribe Omada, refer to Omada? And I'm like, you work for Intermountain? Like,
I do, right? I mean, I have to say more than once, I've looked on both your website and Virta's website to figure out how people who aren't covered through their employers could sign up. And so far, there's been no path, at least for you guys.
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of stuck. You're stuck with the integrated health systems because they obviously have plans. They can pay for Omada and provide the care. And I mean, we have dozens and dozens of fee-for-service health systems as customers, but for their employees. But models like Access maybe able to kind of crack that door open a little bit more broadly, which would feel really good.
I want to close on New Year reflections, but also on a bigger conversation about affordability. This is the number one voting issue for Americans, and it's the thing that's on everybody's mind. And I think for many people looking at their premium payments and hearing all this talk about innovation, they get super frustrated because they're like, I don't really care about innovation. I care about paying less out of my own paycheck every month. I want to ask two questions related to that. One is, and this goes back to what you were saying about the epidemiologist looking at the trends, what would it take for solutions like Omada to actually shift the cost curve and what consumers pay out of pocket every month for their premiums?
Affordability is the thing. I mean, it's like I was looking at this study in 2002. I think diabetes was like one of every $7 spent. So it's you know, you've got this incredible tsunami of disease burden and disease incidence. A lot of that's chronic. I mean, that's the burden we're bearing as a country, and that meets a care model that's not suited to address it leads to massive inaffordability of the system, and so. The only way to bring down healthcare costs are completely transformed care models. That's the only way. It's kind of like almost thank goodness we're at a moment where those models are being supported and being scaled nationally. Thank goodness we're at a moment where technologies like AI can help add even more efficiency and help scale clinicians. And it's like in lack of that, I don't know what we do as a country. I mean, that's kind of like our only way out are different care models and care models that leverage new technologies.
And that reward the outcomes we want.
Yeah.
Exactly. Not otherwise. If you were emperor for the day or king of the country, hopefully we'll never have that, but what would be a structural change you would make that would complement Omada's work to make people healthier and healthcare more affordable? So something you could just overnight change that would be a complement to what you're trying to do.
I would create asynchronous E&M codes.
Okay, that is not what I thought you would say. Say more about that.
So there's this anchor that's happening on a daily basis in that what we pay for in large part in U.S. healthcare is billing for time with a licensed professional. that is what in part enables the wrong care models, because people don't want that. And the average clinician right now, I mean, they'll do their visits either virtual or in person during the day, and then at night try to burn down their MyChart messages. But if we could find a way to create some sort of payment on some version of an episode that's not tied to time, but tied to, like, now you can engage asynchronously with this clinician, and there, you need to have some governance around it. I don't know how many messages would be included in that code, but what that could transform healthcare meaningfully and counterintuitively modifying the fee-for-service billing to accommodate for async would enable more providers to take on risk and go to value. You can get the Oak Streets or the others that are like full cap MA. We can design totally different care models because we're just paid at a population level. But the issue is the vast majority of providers have split business.
Yeah.
And so that creates a huge challenge. You can't operationalize a totally different care model for 30% of your patients that happen to be on an at-risk contract if the 70% are still billed for time. Like, you just can't do it. And yeah. So the biggest headwind, in my view, to actually transitioning the healthcare system toward value-based care is the fact that fee-for-service care is just billed based on time. And so that would be the wand I would wave. And I think it's an esoteric technical one, but it would make a big difference.
And so this provides a channel to create innovation and change in fee-for-service Medicare that we really haven't had to date.
I agree. And I mean, at the end of the day, it's like the payment model has to support a different operational model. Otherwise, it won't exist. So yeah, so that's what I do.
We'll be watching. Closing out the conversation, I want to just do a quick look back, look forward. Two things. One, what's something you're really curious about as we begin 2026?
I'm really curious to see how the sophistication of models improve over the course of this year. Are we at some plateau where to get to that next level of sophistication and quality, it's going to take some time, or does it just keep going through the exponential kind of curve and ramp? At any given moment, I have ChatGPT pinned, Anthropic pinned, Gemini pinned, Grok pinned. I like run all my queries parallel to like just test the latest frontiers of like whatever, what the model's doing. So that's what I'm really curious about. What pace of software innovation will continue here? And then how we can best leverage it, for Omada, especially within the context of supporting members on GLPs.
Love it. And what's something that happened in 2025 that's really sticking with you as we move into the new year?
I mean, the IPO was pretty cool. It was a... It was a cool experience. I was able to bring my kids there. In fact, my daughter rang the bell. I technically still have never rung the bell. It was kind of a special thing. I mean, if anything, I try to downplay the IPO because it's like a checkpoint on a journey. And, it's not like you're doing something differently. You just, it's kind of a different stage. But it was a pretty special experience. I mean, not many entrepreneurs, found a company, that end up going public. And, Omada's kind of my first thing. I mean, I founded it when I was 27. I never hired anybody. didn't know what a VC was. Pretty green.
Question always is that ignorance actually why you've been like thinking back to the grid? Like sometimes it's
possibly
better not to know when you start.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot I wish I had known, but possibly. Maybe some of the ignorance was bliss.
Oh, goodness. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining. Have a great week next week. And just been a real pleasure to have you on and loved hearing the stories.
Yeah, my pleasure. Always fun to reconnect.
Sean and I closed out this conversation with his thoughts on CMS's new access model and why he's cautiously optimistic about it. It has all the ingredients that we need for Medicare innovation: a pathway beyond fee-for-service, accountability for outcomes, and a model that can bring virtual care closer to medical homes. If CMS can get the details right, access has the potential to bring continuous care to the Medicare members who need it most. And that would be a great thing. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Sean Duffy and Omada Health. There is more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.